Dr. Lloyd, I think the last time we talked, we ended pretty much talking about your activities in the Southwest Pacific and bringing back a secret report. And we didn't have much time to talk about your involvement through the U.S. Adjutant General's Office in Europe. I was wondering if we could pick up there today.
Well, sure, I think so. Actually, I went over to Europe about 7 months after I came back off duty in Southwest Pacific. Flew over and converted B-24, as well, the usual transportation of the days. It has none of the facilities that you have in a present-day airliner, not even the ones the Navy used during the war, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
I came back from Southwest Pacific in a naval plane. I preferred that because I almost landed in water going out.
Mm-hmm. I recall you mentioning that.
I had a choice coming back. That one, I recall, it took 18 hours to come from Hawaii into San Francisco, but you didn't have a bunk in there, you could sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I was Yan stationed in the Pentagon for, and they had Adjutant General's, the Adjutant General's Office of the Army itself, for that period of time. Did I mention how I'd been asked for to return to the Southwest Pacific and how I got to Europe?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, I was doing my general work here in the Pentagon, and the Adjutant General of the Southwest Pacific asked if I'd be returned there for duty whenever I'd been in the state appropriate period of time, and I expected to go back. However, one day I ran into the corridors there, General Ralph Lovett, who's dead now, but he'd been my chief of my, I guess you call it division,
mm-hmm.
of the Adjutant General's Office in the Pentagon prior to my going out to Southwest Pacific. In the meantime, he'd gone to Europe, been assigned over there, and he was the Adjutant General for General Eisenhower's headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran, just met there in one of the corridors, and he said, "Well, Lloyd, I thought you was in Southwest Pacific." And I said, "I thought you were in Europe." He'd been a colonel before, and I'd been when I was a lieutenant, he'd been a colonel when I was a major then.
Mm-hmm.
And we chatted a few minutes, and he said, "I'd like to have you over in Europe with me. Are you going back somewhere overseas?" And I said, "Yes, already have orders. I'm going back to the Southwest Pacific." He said, "Well," said, "you really like to go away?" And I said, "Well, I don't. That's not the question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a good soldier, and I go where they want me to go."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Would you mind if I asked for you to go over to Europe?" I said, "I don't think it's doing good, General, because these orders have been issued, and I'll be going in another couple of months." He said, "Well, I'll go up the stairs and talk to George about it." That was George Marshall, who was chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. George C. Marshall.
To my great surprise, shortly thereafter, my orders changed, so I'd go to Europe and sign in Europe. Dwight Hammersley, who was a major at that time, but when I was a lieutenant colonel, who was from Lexington, and I'd known him before quite a while, and he went over in the same B-24 that I did. Our first introduction to the war in Europe was very close to the Spanish border. We left about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning from Washington, and of course they last reached us out in the ocean pretty soon. But we, just before we got into the continent, we saw our first ship had been bombed by the German submarines, going up in smoke. So our pilots flew down low, and we circled the ship to see if there's any lifeboats left or anybody we could rescue. So I don't know how we'd have gotten to them,
mm-hmm.
if we had, but at least we could have informed us. Nearest by ships.
Mm-hmm. You certainly were not a PBY type, were you?
No. And we didn't see any, but the ship was burning and just about to go down. We had no idea and couldn't find out at that time whether they'd gotten the survivors off or what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on in and landed at the outskirts of Paris.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a date on this, do you recall?
I think that was about April 45.
Mm-hmm.
Late March or early April, mm-hmm. I just forgot the exact
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
I know spring was sort of around the corner, still
mm-hmm.
cold.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was, on the other hand, the Paris had just been taken shortly
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
And we were had the headquarters of the European theater at that time in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And we got quarters there. I remember the first night they put us on a, pretty much of a flea box, they might call it. The hotel that the Germans had taken over during the war and used for their non-commissioned officers.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't good enough for their commissioned officers.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we got into it, so I found there's a great amount of sort of dicking around about getting quarters in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, while some of the best hotels have been taken over, all the higher-ranking officers were in the Hotel George Saint. They're on the Champs-Élysées. And shortly thereafter, they moved us out of this dump and put us into a little better hotel that's right on the Champs-Élysées, Hotel Jubilee. And that also had been a German non-com hotel.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly thereafter, I ran into one of my former students down there. Champs-Élysées, and his name is Virgil Phillips. He's up at Olive Hill, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And we were glad to see each other, and I said, well, Philip, what are you doing over here? He said, well, I'm assigned to the same base area. I'm supposed to be the slot supply officer. Well, he said, I said, that's good. Several things you do as supply officer. Same base area covered all the environs and so on of Paris. I said, that means you probably have under your general direction signing quarters. You're also in charge of the liquor rations, things such thing as that. He said, that's right. Well, I said, I want to see if they can't get a little better quarters than I have at the time. Well, he asked me to have lunch with this person who was a girl, or woman rather, who was in charge of the reservations and so on. And so she picked me out some places that might be available. The result of my meeting up with Virgil there and telling him my problems, remembering his old political science teacher, she took me down to Hotel Prince de Gaulle, which was right next door to George Saint, but had
mm-hmm.
a reputation among the younger officers as being a much better foxhole than the George Saint. So George
mm-hmm.
Saint, presumably where the higher-ranking officer stayed, was supposed to be a higher-ranked hotel, but
mm-hmm.
the George Saint's was a little stuffy, most of them though. Prince de Gaulle had a better dining room and a better bar and all that sort of thing. So I wound up in staying at the Prosper Gold, mainly because I tossed Philip Slice back in Moorhead years before.
Mm-hmm.
Very shortly thereafter, though, the whole, well, they sent me into Germany before the war was over, and on some special duties. But I managed to get back from Germany. We knew enough about the war about then. I managed to get back to Paris, where I still had some quarters.
Can you give us an outline of what you did in Germany?
Well, it is somewhat similar to what I did in the Southwest Pacific.
Mm-hmm. So you were carrying secret...
I was making studies of the replacement system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they were getting the kind of men they needed, the mm-hmm. trainers they were needed, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
which was an administrative type thing mm-hmm. for the Italian General's Office.
Mm-hmm. And now, was this classified as well?
Most of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with the G1 from General Eisenhower's headquarters. I was assigned to go with the representative of G1's office.
I see.
And we studied these various things. And we went to the 3rd Army, the 6th Army, the 7th Army,
mm-hmm.
and attempted to find out through their staff as to what the problems were on
mm-hmm.
replacements.
Mm-hmm.
And
basically, what did the report say?
Well, it was working pretty well. Not perfectly, but working pretty well. You might be interested in knowing that when we were down at visiting General Patton's office, I heard him make a speech for his men, just very much like George Scott made in the
movie
Patton. George Scott probably portrayed him even better than he was from a standpoint of speaking voice and that sort of thing. And probably used less cuss words. But that's the type of thing we're doing. Mm-hmm. And
well, you told me that Patton, I believe you told me at one point that Patton had a rather high, light voice.
Yes.
Whereas George C. Scott in the movie version came across with yeah. much more masculine sounding
very voice, much so.
Command type voice.
Yeah. George Scott had a much better command voice than
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Patton was well liked by his men, though.
Mm-hmm.
He was what you call a soldier.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk with people directly about Patton? I mean,
pardon?
When you went on this mission into Germany or elsewhere, did you talk directly with officers and men about Patton?
Well, no, not usually. We worked with their assistants and
with their
usually
assistants.
The heads of the. We talked. We went visit some of the
mm-hmm.
units in the armies
mm-hmm.
and so on,
mm-hmm.
and. Determine whether or not they were really getting the type of qualified men that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, another job I was assigned over there, following the actual peace, was Germany.
Mm-hmm.
We had, of course, Japanese war was still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was going to have to be a shift of troops from where the war had ended into
mm-hmm.
where the war is still going
right.
on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an important part of the planning at
sure.
that time, and we had a point system as
mm-hmm.
to if a person had been stayed in Europe long enough to have
mm-hmm.
a certain number of points. What, telephone?
Yeah, telephone.
Excuse me.
Okay.
I'm not exactly, I don't remember exactly where I was when I went to answer the telephone.
Let's see. Well, we had just been talking generally about...
Well, about the the movement of troops from Europe into the Southwest Pacific.
To the east.
One of the things that we were trying to do and worked out in planning and was to try to hire civilians in these various mm-hmm. places to take the place of some of our American troops who would be going to the Pacific. We had worked out the system, and that I did quite a bit of traveling on that assignment to like Luxembourg,
mm-hmm.
Belgium,
mm-hmm.
Finland, not Finland, but Denmark,
mm-hmm.
In which we would set up an American office under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Army as the General Department to hire civilians from that country, and we'd pay them in their own currency.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd pay the government in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're new, we'd just give them the government some dollars and
mm-hmm.
to be deposited in their bank accounts at home, and that pleased all these European governments at that time that they were tickled us again. And these people were tickled us, so glad to get a job with the American Army
mm-hmm.
because of the pay.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be paid, in, once worked in Germany for us, would be paid in German marks for part of it, for the living expenses, but dollars would be deposited in the bank for them. Same is true in all the other countries. And I went into Luxembourg and Belgium and Denmark. And we had, of course, an office in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go, but there was our office set up some offices in other places like Holland and
mm-hmm.
so on. We found that we were helpful and we could get very capable people
mm-hmm.
for the job we wanted to do. I went also, we did some in England too. That took place pretty much during the fall of peace with Germany and during the fall of 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And in we had a new Adjutant General, my Adjutant General, General Lovett, decided he was supposed to go back to the States in November. About around Thanksgiving. He asked me if I wouldn't stay over there until he went back. I could have gone back earlier than that mm-hmm. little on points.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in the Army, when a general asks you to stay, he doesn't mean that you have a choice. Exactly. When he says he'd like to have me stay till mm-hmm. he went back, said we'd both go back for Thanksgiving and be home at Christmas. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, yes, sir. As it turned out, we had a new adjutant general who came over about the, I guess, around October,
mm-hmm.
latter part of October, who I had known in the Southwest Pacific. He was had been an adjutant general under General MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
And I had known him, and he came and arrived over there, and I explained to him that we had this house there in Germany, a very good house. General Lovett had been assigned, and it's the only house I ever found in all of Germany that had 7 bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans are clean people, but they're not much on having lots of bathrooms. And we knew that this was had to be owned by Nazis, because no one except a Nazi would have been allowed to have a house like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we took it over and had General Lovett and myself and 2 other lieutenant colonels lived in it. And we did not say anything the other day about the household Germans we had there.
No, I don't believe so. We had talked some about... No.
Well, anyway,
I don't believe so. I don't think that.
Our headquarters, when we went into Germany, were in the city of Frank without mine.
Mm-hmm. No, we didn't talk about this part.
And that was supposed to be our permanent headquarters as long as we occupied Germany. And the Air Force had been very helpful to the Army because they planned ahead of time to, the Army had to occupy the apartment buildings,
mm-hmm.
which had huge buildings they had there in Frankfurt am Main, and they, when bombing the town, the city, they bombed all around and left the IG apartment buildings intact. So that gave the American Army a bunch of good buildings, and still heatable and,
mm-hmm.
and maintained, and we did not build anything.
Well, the apartment buildings intentionally left intact?
Yeah, yeah.
You would think as a military target that they would want to take those out.
Well,
I mean, the Farben.
They did a great job of bombing all the way around them.
Mm-hmm.
But the war, you know, was almost over then anyway.
Mm-hmm.
When
mm-hmm.
This was in the last stage of the war that they planned. And we had barbed wire entanglement
mm-hmm.
around all the buildings. But and most of the part of the town we occupied. But after the war was over, and then particularly after the Japanese war was over,
mm-hmm.
well, then we were free to go to take over other places. And General Lovett indicated he would like to get a little way out from the city, not to live right by the office there all the time, go to work 7 days a week anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So he told us to go and look for a place that would be a little ways out and comfortable and but easily accessible to the headquarters. We found that in a little city called Kronberg. It was right down the foot of the Taunus Mountains where the Friedrichshafer Castle
mm-hmm.
was up on the mountain. That's where the Kaiser Wilhelm's mother lived. So we found this house that had 7 bathrooms, and so we immediately sort of did a little shifting of rooms and that sort of thing, and so each officer really had a small suite, a bedroom and a sort of living room and a bath. I called up the burgomaster down in the city of Kronberg. I told him that General Lovett was going to move in, and we were going to take over. We instructed the people to move within 24 hours. And we needed 2 cooks, 2 maids, a furnace boy, and a gardener. And we were going to pay them their going wage at the rate of dollars in exchange for marks.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Germany at that time. So now we paid that to ourselves because that's the officers supposed to do that for themselves at peacetime. And but the wage was very low. It was $2.50 a week. I'm sure all of them would have worked for nothing if just to get food, because
mm-hmm.
we fed them and we had got a sufficient supply of food.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out very well, and we used to drive back and forth to work every day. And I liked the German people. They were industrious, clean, worked hard, and one of them that worked was a prisoner of war, a boy by the name of Norbert. He was about 17, but he'd gone into the German army when he was 14. The only stipulation we put on the thing was to see one of the servants had to speak good English, excellent English, and be able to translate into German, because we didn't, of course, the whole headquarters was supposed to be, have no fraternization with the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe I said last time, I was telling you about General Patton, was very much opposed to that. But everybody pretty much did that way. And I didn't ever let them know I knew anything about German. I told the general I did not speak German and would not learn German. And this girl, the only one that could speak good English, was a true Nazi. She's been a member of the Nazi Jugend.
Mm-hmm.
And she's grown up under Hitler. And she, mm-hmm. She's mm-hmm. only about 21, 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So her whole life mm-hmm. has been Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained to her that we were not going to learn German. The Germans had their servants, they had to obey. And if they failed to obey an order, if they didn't understand it, failed to obey an order, it'd be just the same as they did deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her job to be sure she heard every order given by the general or any of the officers living there. And she conveyed that exactly the way it's given to her compatriots who didn't understand English much. Because if we failed to obey an order, we'd just shoot them. And she translated exactly the way I said it.
Mm.
And, you know, they all nodded. Yes, ja, das ist gut, das ist gut. They respect. They respect.
Okay.
When I told that story to my wife, she said that was terrible. I shouldn't have ever talked like that to German people. But the thing about it is, the German people respect authority, but in any, they had one of the finest armies in the world because of the discipline. And they obeyed orders. And they respected to do that. They expected mm-hmm. you to be very definite about what you'd do if they didn't obey orders.
Mm-hmm.
So, my wife also thought I was terrible to that we gave them only 24 hours notice.
To move.
To move.
Mm-hmm.
But if you gave them any more than that, when you give them only 24 hours, they get the most precious possessions and get out. When you give them more time than that, they'll booby trap the whole place and get a bunch of people killed.
Mm.
There are a lot of times when people moved in, Americans moved into a German home, they'd have a Leica camera on them. One of the possessions left of all Americans are trying to get a hold of Leica cameras.
Mm-hmm.
American GIs. And so they'd go and grab that first thing and blow up in the face.
Mm.
Or they'd see a painting on the wall sideways. And you know, it's a perfect natural thing to go and straighten up a painting, picture on the wall, and that'd blow up.
Mm.
Or they'd flush the toilet and it'd blow up.
Mm.
A lot of them were killed that way.
I see your point.
Well, not only that, but before any house I ever went into, I wanted to, didn't want to take that kind of chance with anybody with me. So we used to got some German prisoners, had them move, go in ahead of time, move everything while we watched them.
Mm.
Now, none of my prisoners ever blown up, but it was a good precaution.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. So this was a common procedure, therefore, within the higher staff to do this.
Well, they yes, they were smart. Mm-hmm. You did.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans were very tricky. They had a good army. I think they certainly had an army that was not only probably one of the best in the world. But they were such so well disciplined, that's point of weakness. Now, where the Americans, I think, had the advantage over the Germans is that we were more adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans had been trained to the point and disciplined to the point that if everything had to go with the book. The Germans were extremely good soldiers, but unless things went according to the way they'd been instructed, according to plan, you might say,
mm-hmm.
they were very difficult to be able to change what was normal and the plan had been instructed on to something different. One time I later, this is much later than that time, I was over in Denmark, but this was in Norway. And I was over on some business, and a young man, a young Norwegian that worked in the American embassy there, when finding out I'd been in World War II and so on, took me around to see things, that sort of thing. And he and his brother, they lived there, and his brother had been part of the underground during the war. And he would slip back through one of the passes over the mountains to see his family occasionally and slip out again at night. But the Germans had a rule, if they caught any Norwegian with a gun, the verdict was death. And so he couldn't have any protection because he couldn't bring a gun with him or take one away. So he showed me a pass up there on the mountain where his brother was slipping up back one night away from the business family, and suddenly ran into a German sentry who hollered, "Halt!" Had his gun on him. But he was close enough to the sentry, he thrust the gun aside, but in the meantime knocked his helmet off. Guess what the German did? His helmet was going down, falling down the mountain, and he ran down to get his helmet because he'd been taught all along you don't go into combat or anything without the helmet on. And so he chased his helmet, no reason got away.
That's interesting.
But really, that is you can have too much discipline. Now, the American Army was very good at being able to change things and just sort of. Well, the Germans would. The Germans would take string fine piano wires you could see in daylight from one tree to another on some of these narrow highways, and the American GIs would be going down highway at a fairly great speed, and the top down, the glass down on the hood, piano wire cut the neck, cut their heads off, things like that. They were very clever on those things. And you had to watch always for some type of thing that the Germans would do that you might not expect them to do. But that's all part of training, and the fortunate thing for me is that was that I had trained in the reserves for many years before I had to go into war. Just being observant is a great thing.
You're very cognizant of those kinds of things.
If you've been trained properly, you sense something's wrong without hardly noticing it. You just know something's wrong in that particular spot.
Did you have any particularly harrowing experiences of that sort?
Well, some of them. The worst was, I'd say, some of them have in New Guinea, and some of the soldiers there were killed because they didn't follow orders. They were told to dig a foxhole wherever they were, and they dig the foxhole because some sergeant, somebody had seen that did it. But Americans like to be comfortable at night. Frequently, men they were told not to do this, but frequently men would take a shelter half. All of them had these shelter halves, two of them make pumpkins. And they'd cover the foxhole with a shelter half. And of course it rained every night, practically it rained all the time in New Guinea. Seemed to me like. So Japs would infiltrate at night, creeping feet along on hands and knees, crawling. Because you wouldn't hear it. You'd hear noises, but there are always noises in the jungle. And they'd creep along until they felt some cactus. And they know there's a man or two men under there. So they jumped in with a bayonet or a knife. Now, if they felt the hole, they were less inclined to do that because they didn't know what was in the hole. And they knew if a man was in the hole, he could see enough a shadow over him. There's always enough light on the moon, even in a heavy jungle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That you can see a shadow, something cutting off part of the flight. A jet might be shot right there and while it leaned over. But there are many times when they, you have to notice things just like the Indians used to do in this country. You might have an enemy break off a twig or something getting into the hiding place where it shouldn't be broken or a flight path looking like a place.
Sure.
You always watch those things.
Interesting.
None of these things are particularly points of strategy. To make a long story short, I served there in Germany under this. I was talking a while ago about this new general came over there, and I told him I was supposed to go back to General Lovett. And he said, "Hell, Lloyd, you're the only guy I know in this outfit. You're going to stay." So I stayed until February 46, then, instead of going back to Thanksgiving and getting home for Christmas. But that taught me something, too, because when I did get back home, I was still a lieutenant colonel, and they wanted me to stay on duty. Well, they asked me if I wouldn't accept a permanent commission in the regular army, but I had just gotten married at the time of the war started, and I had a child at home, a wife, and a farm hadn't been looked after properly during the wartime, and I didn't see where I wanted to stay in the regular army.
Mm-hmm.
They said, "Well, if you stay 60 days, you'll be qualified to be a full colonel." And I said, "Well, I've seen the army change its regulations too many times, so I'll go back and be discharged and right to the enlisted into the Army Reserves, because in 60 days they might change the mine and make it longer." But I did that purposely because of the fact that I knew it would be better, easier to find an assignment in the Army Reserves as a lieutenant colonel than it would be a full colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that way.
So you came back to Kentucky at that point?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I still took them. We had had these training courses you could take at one center here in Lexington where they gave Command and General Staff School courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I took those and so on. That enabled me when it came time to be promoted to a full colonel, I became a full colonel. And then when later on I was active in the reserve, later on when I was in Washington with the Burley and Darkleaf Tobacco Export Association, and Governor Combs was elected to the governor's place, and I'd been for him 4 years ago when he lost. He wanted me to come back and take a state job and offered me a couple of jobs that I did not care for, but finally offered me the job as adjutant general.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew by that job, which put me into a category where I could serve in an office calling for the rank of a major general, they enabled me to in the National Guard, where you have to have the same qualification to be promoted to any office or rank as you do in the regular Army. And by had I stayed in the reserves without accepting the Adjutant General's appointment, I would have been retired by the, under iron rules as a full colonel in July 1960.
Mm-hmm.
By becoming Adjutant General in command of the Kentucky National Guard, Army National Guard, and Air National Guard,
mm-hmm.
I could serve in the grade calling for a two-star general.
Oh.
And so after I'd been in there, I became a state rank to appointed two-star general, appointed by the governor. But that doesn't mean too much unless you can get confirmed by the Senate and recognized by the federal government. So after a few months, when they had an officer board, a general officer board up there in Washington, I was recommended for it, and I had enough time and grade and so on, I became recognized as a regular two-star general.
In the regular Army?
Well, not in the regular Army, but in the Army National Guard.
Army National Guard. Right.
But federal recognition meant that I had the grade, and when retired, I would draw whatever the retirement pay was for my grade and number of years, which is the reason I left Washington again, came back to Kentucky.
That's it. Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of territory for between the last time we spoke and today, from when you were a private to as you came out as a two-star general.
Well, I was fortunate then that I served. I was the first man since back in 1820 that served as Adjutant General under two governors and for a period as long as 8 years.
Hmm. That's interesting. I didn't realize you had served under second governor as well.
Well, I was reappointed by Governor Breathitt when he came in office. General Billy Wellman, who's in there now, is going to beat my record. Matter of fact, I expect he's already beaten it. Because I think he's exceeded 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any questions you have on?
Yeah. But what about your state service when you came back in the late 1940s? Is there anything you need to you should be adding here? Did you serve somewhat under Roscoe Murray?
Yes. I came back, as I said, I reverted back to the reserves as a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was still in the reserves and still what you might call a weekend soldier,
mm-hmm.
I became a full colonel. And I, Roscoe Murray, I knew Roscoe when he was a lieutenant, second lieutenant, and I was a sergeant down at Fort Knox in 1926.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased to be in the reserves at the time he was Adjutant General in the National Guard. And he was kind enough to offer me, to ask me if I desired to, and would recommend I be ordered to camp with the National Guard to do my 2 weeks annual duty. Besides, I attended, of course, some other meetings with the reserves, or sometimes once a month, or that sort of thing. But each time, in that period of time, Roscoe Murray was Adjutant General under Governor Clements.
Right. 40 years.
And during that period of time, I was also employed in Frankfort, a good part of the time. And I used to go to camp in the National Guard most of the time.
Mm-hmm. So when you were heading the LRC, you were also going to camp?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that full 2 weeks active duty. And when I was up in Washington, I went to the over in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, and I'm not a Kentuckian, but as I understand it, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, there was some fear among the Kentucky Union ranks that both the new state police and the National Guard might be used as as an anti-labor, you know, strike-breaking force. Do you have any comment on this, and did you have any experiences relating, you know, to this problem?
Well, I know something about it. It wasn't a question of maybe. Actually, the National Guard has always been used in most states when they have any type of civil disobedience, including strikes and that sort of thing, and the citizens are endangered. The governor has the power to order out the National Guard to take what action is necessary to quell it.
Yeah, true, but you know, the Guard can be used in a rather nonpartisan way.
Oh, yeah,
and well, as a,
yeah,
as
they,
a buffer,
they,
or can be used in a very partisan, direct way, you know,
that's
against
correct.
Labor. So, you know, obviously, labor had some reason,
well,
possibly, to have a fear based upon historical.
What you were talking about is the things like you have a flood, or tornado or something like that. The governors always send out the National Guard to help out people, but they were used in Kentucky and strike issues even before the time you speak about. I was never sent on a, I was not in the National Guard during that period of time. I was never sent on a strike thing, but they, I know they were used in Harlan and various other places in Kentucky. Matter of fact, my predecessor used them, was ordered by the governor and used them in connection with the integrating school systems.
Were you involved?
I was never involved in that because I was in that time, that period of time I was in the reserves.
Okay. I didn't know if you were
in the reserves,
called up for special service.
No, the reserves were are only called out by the President of the United States. The National Guard is called out by the governor.
I see. Okay.
And if the President wants to use the National Guard, he has to get the governor's permission and order them out as federalized troops instead of National Guardsmen.
Well, perhaps we could turn a few minutes to your assignment as adjutant general, the milestones of your service as Kentucky adjutant general, if we still have a few minutes to get into that.
Well, I enjoyed that job as much as any I've ever had. I had to work very hard at it. I told the troops on the day of inauguration when the governor appointed me, and they had a sort of walking thing back in Frankfurt about the, for the new adjutant general. Because the adjutant general is, under Kentucky custom, is the first appointment by the governor. It goes way back to the time that they appointed the adjutant general in order to supposedly protect the governor. You might say Daniel Boone was the first Kentucky adjutant general, or National Guardsman, because he was a colonel in the troops of Kentucky. But I told this fellas that I said I'd known most of them because I'd gone to camp with the National Guard so many times. I knew a lot of the officers. And I told them I didn't expect to be the best adjutant general the Guard ever had in Kentucky. But I did think I'd be the hardest workman, I certainly tried to be. And I had good relations with all the officers and men during that period of time. I made another policy which hadn't been done very much up to that time. In every troop, whether it was a company or a regiment or battalion or whatnot, that went into annual field training for 2 weeks in some federal army post, I visited them, both air and army. And I think that helped me to keep in touch better with what was going on in it than many previous adjutant generals have been able to do. But it was a very satisfactory type position that I enjoyed. And all of my previous military experience was a big help to us, too.
What were the major issues or problems that you faced as adjutant general, as you look back? You know, if you were to kind of, you know, think back in hindsight over, you know, what your contribution was in that period, you know, what would you like to think about most?
Well, one of the early ones, you recall, is that they had a big explosion down in one of the factories down in Lowell, maybe. The city administration in Lowell was belonged to one party, and the state administration to another party, and the city administration wasn't very cooperative. Because they were always trying to find something they could blame on the state administration.
Mm-hmm.
I was happened to be talking on the telephone that day to somebody in Louisville when suddenly a loud noise took place. And I said, "What in the world is that for?" I said, "I don't know, it's a whaling explosion, but I don't know what it is exactly. Hold on, I'll find out." And one of the factories out there along the river had blown up. Well, I knew from the damage that this fellow imagined that they'd have to call out the National Guard, because any time you have a thing like that, your electrical wires is torn up, your pipes for water and heating and all, and everything blown up, and you have to evacuate.
Mm-hmm.
And the Guard does a great job in helping people evacuate and so on. But then you have possibility of looters coming in and looting
mm-hmm.
all the houses.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that it's just a matter of time that the Guard had to be called out. So I called the governor and I told him I'd heard about this explosion. I thought it was going to be serious. That they probably had to close off a section, and they did finally close off a section of about a mile in radius. And I thought he'd be asked to call out the National Guard. And he said, well, he said, "I think so too." He said, "I don't think they'll call them out, want me to call them out until the last minute. They want to make us look like we're unprepared." He said, "Go ahead and make your preparations. And the time you think you need to be called out after they ask me, you tell me you're ready and you be called out immediately."
Mm-hmm.
Well, that made sense. He said, "Go down low right now." I got in the car and picked up one or two officers and went. We found it to be even worse when he talked from there, a telephone call. A great deal of damage had been caused, and the explosion still taking place.
Mm-hmm.
I took this action. We had a large number of troops near Lowell. We had a system already prepared for an emergency whereby each man would call two men.
Mm-hmm.
Those two men would call two more men each. So you got a whole, whatever that size unit, you'd get notice to all, most of them
mm-hmm.
within a short time. And they would report to the armies when they got to the armory, wherever they were based, at a certain time. So we alerted the people that on duty to each army to start that system moving. I went down and looked at the situation, talked to the mayor of Lowell, was out of town, that took, didn't get back till the night. Nobody wanted to do anything until he got back. In the meantime, my men were been alerted and are moving into the armies. They didn't ask me to get a hold of the governor and get the Guard called out until about 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. This explosion took place at 11 o'clock that morning.
Mm.
But they didn't know it. I said, "What do you want us to do?" They said, "Well, get your men in here quick to do. They're going to have looting tonight and the police can't hunt it." Well, I said, "What I'll do is to instruct the National Guard to cover the entire place you're blocking off."
Mm-hmm.
And at each entrance, post of entrance, we'll have some guard and station now, station. Your policemen will be the ones who go in and see whether or not watching looters or doing arresting. I'm not empowering my men to arrest or shoot somebody, but your policemen will look at you.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed to that. So the guardsmen merely kept people out. And if people didn't want to go into homes, a policeman went with the police car, escorted them in there to get something and back out again. And they were checked in and out. But if we hadn't been ready, we'd have been, it'd have been a big mess that night, but
mm-hmm.
the state government would have been criticized severely.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Which then becomes a political problem.
Yeah. Another time was when...
can I ask another question here? Who did you deal with in the state, in the city administration during this?
Who did I deal with? The mayor.
The mayor himself?
I'm kind of judge. You're kind of judge.
Okay, so you were dealing directly on that level?
Yeah.
Okay.
They were cooperative. As mm-hmm. far as I was concerned, I was just doing a job.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't for or against me politically
yeah.
or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was just doing a job.
Mm-hmm.
Another instance was when Martin Luther King said he's going to stop the Derby
mm-hmm.
During Bress's administration. And the governor, and really the Churchill Down authorities were very much upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
The governor asked me to go down and talk to him about it and see what we could work out. And I got my staff people together. The officers had great confidence in. And I said, I want you to take, we had one kind of a jam session on, sounds crazy, but I said, I want you, if you were a fellow that you wanted to stop the Derby in order to get national publicity, how would you go about it? And I don't care how crazy it sounds, I want you to speak up and say, how would you go about it? Well, they came up with some crazy things. One fellow said he'd get one or two old cars. It wasn't worth anything, but so long as it... Sorry. As long as they could run?
Yeah.
He'd get one or two old cars that weren't worth anything much and take them out, drive out of the Waterton Expressway, and let something get wrong with them in the middle of the road. He'd get out and set them on fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I bet would have made the biggest traffic jam you ever saw.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another one kid, well, what he'd do if he wanted to stop the Derby, he'd take a couple of crates of live chickens out in the infield. And just before the Derby, he'd turn loose on the track. Now, you know.
Only in Kentucky it would take yeah. chickens.
Well, you know, a thoroughbred horse is a very temperamental animal, and
uh-huh.
something like that, it was just scary. If yeah. somebody got killed, they would jump the fences and
mm-hmm.
other things.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So, but we consider all those things.
Seriously considered those, I imagine.
And mm-hmm. so we investigated, we found that the city of Louisville at that time had a contract with one garage downtown to send wreckers.
Mm-hmm.
That place had two wreckers that they could call on for Church of the Islands, got if the highway or around
mm-hmm.
expressway what got blocked for something. Well, I didn't think that was enough. I also found that they customarily only had one, most two paddy wagons where arrested city police would arrest people, take them
mm-hmm.
down to jail
mm-hmm.
and book them. And that wasn't enough. Fortunately, we found a building over there back of the stables at Churchill Downs, that was kind of a warehouse building that was vacant. We rented. We put this heavy, strong wire, built a bunch of cages in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we could hold something like 2,000 or 3,000 people if we rested them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had a number of tank wreckers because we had some tank units in Kentucky at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We had these big wreckers that could lift a tank.
Mm-hmm.
We brought some of those into Lowell and placed them along the side of the Waters Expressway.
Mm.
They could have picked, if somebody had a car, stopped it, and put match to it, one of the records could have picked it up and tossed it right over out of the lane entirely. Would not move it, just toss it. Because you couldn't, if you ever had a way to block, you couldn't get anywhere anyway.
Sure.
We had I asked, got an attorney's opinion on this. I asked, what could we do if a bunch of these people weight went down? Some one of my men said he thought the best thing for them to do would be to go out and just lie down in front of the starting gate.
Mm-hmm.
There the horses run over.
Mm.
And I found that you, from the attorney, that we had no power to move a man off the track if he's lying there just taked out on the middle of the track. We had no authority. We could tell him to move, but if he refused to move, we couldn't do much to him. However, if he became mobile and jumped up or something, we could. We had enough. We measured the width of the track to find out how many soldiers, shoulder to shoulder, you could have on there. So we had a special outfit and a personnel carrier who were armed, not with the armed rifles, but not with loaded rifles,
mm-hmm.
no live ammunition,
mm-hmm.
but with a bandit.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Attorney General's opinion, if you got him the man to move, you could sort of prod him a little bit with this bandit and he'd move further. But until he moved, you couldn't stick him with a bandit. Of course, I didn't want to hurt anybody anyway.
Right. Yeah, just wanted to move
him. Yeah. We had another group of people, soldiers, who had got these pencil, little pencil type things, discharged as tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, just a little.
Mm-hmm.
So those, this squad with the rifle and men had would move on the people lying across the track and ask them to get up. And do that, they say, you have to get up. Now get up and go.
Mm-hmm.
No, it still didn't do anything. The fellow behind had one man between each two men behind with a tear gas pencil. He was supposed to squirt a little in his eye. He'd jump. If that happened to him, he'd jump. And if he jumped, they could pride him with a man and make him go.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's all on the plan. And we had the people there, these extra troops were not all in sight. We always have troops at the Derby,
mm-hmm.
usually 400 or 500. That day we had 1,200.
Mm.
The reporters kept asking me how many troops we were going to have, and I said, we're just going to have enough. But I had, over in the Army, we had a number of troops who were taking their regular weekend drill on the federal pay that I could order over there if we need them. And we had the personnel carriers that could mm-hmm. carry them through there.
But they weren't actually on, not all of them were actually on the ground.
They weren't actually on the Derby grounds. Mm-hmm.
Were they in uniform?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. in uniform. Mm-hmm. And I changed the uniform, got a breath that said, now the ones you have down there, we, let's make it kind of ceremonial, don't we? Get anybody panicked, but he said, I said, what do you mean ceremony? He said, well, let's have them in dress uniforms and maybe white gloves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't know whether I could talk him out of that or not, but I didn't try at that time. We procured some white gloves, and I got enough of these billets, not the ordinary nightsticks, but these long billets that
mm-hmm.
they use for riots.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have enough in Kentucky, but we borrowed some in the state of Ohio. All of my 12.
About the billy clubs.
Yeah, well, I will say that the officials at Churchill Downs were very cooperative. They were really worried. And I said, they didn't want a lot of people going to the Derby. They didn't want a lot of people staying away on account of the danger.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want a lot of people going out there and getting hurt either.
Sure.
We asked them on the part of the National Guard that if you're going to have the Derby, to do two things. One was, well, three things. Number one, I asked them if they wouldn't build another tunnel passageway under the track. Mm-hmm. They only had one. We'd always had trouble at one because people going and coming both ways, they'd get in there and jammed up, and some of them had claustrophobia, and
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had trouble that way.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if you build another passageway under the downs and the ground itself, track. So one of them will be going entrance into, the other will be exit. So we wouldn't have people crowding up in the middle again.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I asked them to build a chain link fence 6 feet high, completely around the track, 10 feet away from the rail, around the whole infield. Well, of course, both these things were expensive, mm-hmm. but they did it. They thought it was important enough, they did it. And the third thing we asked them to do, that they were somewhat reluctant on, was that they would not permit selling any type of alcoholic beverages in the infield. We weren't worried about the main part of the mm-hmm. track because mm-hmm. Where the seating places are, and the clubhouse and the grandstand and all that,
mm-hmm.
we had enough guards and policemen to mm-hmm. control that, but if it's going to be in trouble, we thought it was coming from the infield.
Mm-hmm. We're trouble usually comes at the
right
time.
Yeah, that's right. And Churchill Downs, they said, oh, we can't do that. We always sold liquor out there. But I said, well, that's where it's going to come if you're going to have self. And I said, I don't think it'll be from the liquor you sell out there, because mm-hmm. you don't put enough mm-hmm. in your drinks to get people stirred up. But
mm-hmm.
if you let somebody take in a whole lot of whiskey and stuff out there, and they'll get the pass around and stir up the crowd, that's where the trouble will be. So they agreed to do that. They said they couldn't do it. I said, if the guard's on duty, they'll stop the people and take away mm-hmm. from them. We did that.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, the commanding general of Fort Knox told me that your men took a bottle of bourbon and a bottle of scotch away from me when I entered the track. I said, why didn't you tell him? He was in civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I said, why didn't you tell him who you were? He said, I'm ashamed to.
That's good.
But they confiscated literally barrels, not they weren't in the barrels, but they had the case lots of whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So somebody was going to get a lot of people drunk over there.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but believe it or not, one group of people had two crates of live chickens that they wanted. They said they were taking them into the infield in order to barbecue them.
Two crates
of live chickens. We confiscated those. So that crazy thing that fellow said wasn't mm-hmm. so crazy at all. But you can imagine what happened.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Mm. We didn't.
Did you interrogate the person with the chickens?
Not to any great amount. They said they would have sworn that they barbecue them. They, you know, they cook and do everything else out there in the infield during Derby Day. So I guess the same problem might have. I don't know what they intend to do with them. But anyway, they didn't get in with them.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any wrecks out on them. Waterston Expressway, and we didn't have any great numbers of people arrested,
mm-hmm.
no more than usual. My orders to the guard, then we had one man with a long right billy, were 8 yard around that whole field track, around this, where they built the fence, behind the fence. Well, I mean, behind from the standpoint of, they were on the outside of the fence, the mm-hmm. infield people on the inside, people
right.
know what I mean.
Right.
Their orders were to time that they started, right? When their off signal came, they were all to about face in a military manner and face the infield and not look at the track at all. Because if anybody's going to break down the fence, they were supposed to pop them in the head as they tried to get over.
Mm.
And that's one of the few derbies I didn't get to see because I was up there on the, where the pavilion is, you know, out where they bring the horse after the derby and so on. And I was up on the roof of that and I watched with my field glasses where I turned them, watched the men guarding the fence and all around the complete track. And they did just what they said, told to do. They were looking for infield. They did not bop anybody. A few kind of ran up the track like that. They were going to take over, but all they had to do is raise that thing up, and they knew not to do that. At the end of the race, I happened to glance one guardman. He didn't really move out of place, but he kind of glanced around to see who's the head of the derby. He's the only one who moved his head. I was very proud of him. And I was very proud of the fact that I talked to the president out of having white gloves in the hands, because nobody looks dangerous in white gloves.
Mm-hmm.
All these guardsmen that day were in battle clothes, helmets, and these long billets.
Mm-hmm.
With exception of the ones we had hidden over in that building, and also over at the armory. Would have been there in 5 minutes if we needed them. So nothing happened.
Did you ever have an opportunity to talk with any of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference people afterwards about this, or the local NACP?
No,
did the governor or anybody else ever get information afterwards
to discuss what
had happened? Or what had not happened
I felt like the guard had done his job and it wasn't important to keep something like that stirred up.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't mean it in that sense.
I'll tell you this. The head of the state police at that time was my nephew of a marriage, Ted Bassett.
Mm-hmm.
He and I worked very closely together.
Mm-hmm. I met him.
We worked very closely together, and for example, a lot of people said, you've got to go down to Derby the night before, you know, they frequently have parties here in Lexington the night before the Derby, and Ted and I both were invited to one of the big parties. We went, because people didn't expect us to be there.
Mm-hmm.
They said, aren't you worried about us? I said, no, we're not going to worry about it. Not going to be in trouble. So, but we did have some plainclothes policemen in plain clothes, unmarked car, following the fellow who said he was going to stop the derby from the time he arrived in Lowell until he left. We knew where he was, what he did, so on. That morning, early in the morning, incidentally, one other thing I didn't say a while ago we planned on. Over at the Armory, which is the armory of the National Guard right there, near the Derby grounds and right along Watson Expressway. Ordinarily, we had a good many vehicles, some few tanks and personnel carriers parked out there on the grounds, but I got all these extra things brought in, tanks and tank wreckers and things like that. We parked them over there. We had all the people taking regular training that day in battle dress, rifles, bayonets, helmets, and that sort of thing, marching out there. And this man who had said he was going to stop the derby drove by very slowly on Washington Expressway and looked over to that armory with a whole car full of them. Looked over and was about 7 o'clock, and these fellas out there drilling. We had brought tanks in here, weren't supposed to be in here from other units, so to speak. We had, looked like a whole division. It didn't look like just what normally happened. And the whole division has 15,000 men, 13 to 15, depending on what kind. And we don't have, didn't have that many in the whole National Guard, but it looked like it. He came back again about 8:30, looked again. They were still over marching, going around, moving tanks and so on. Half an hour later, he called off the demonstration and said he didn't want to have the people of Kentucky upset over anything we were doing and so on.
Okay, I see the correlations then. That's interesting. That's a fascinating story.
We also sent word that there had not been a man killed at the Derby by the National Guard since back in 1940, some odd. We didn't expect to have to do that. Mm-hmm. There was one killed by the National Guard. He either had, I guess, doped in liquor there, you know, along the late 40s. Mm-hmm. He just ran amok. They hit him, kept beating him, and he just died of his injuries. But we said that hadn't had any like that, and we hoped to, didn't expect to have any, but if there's anything done, start to stop the Derby, well, we were ready. And that was sent in a manner that they clearly understood.
That's fascinating. I think most of us do not normally think of the National Guard at Derby time, you know, as the National Guard is being, you know, involved. You know, one just thinks of the various police forces.
Well,
that's a fascinating story.
They're really there to assist the police, because Lowell doesn't have enough police to have them all out there that's on Saturday. And normally the state provides some like 400 or 500. But that day we had 1,200 on the ground. It may have looked to people who knew the thing, it looked like a few more maybe, but not much. And I was very proud of them though when there'd been all this talk, despite the fact we had a big crowd there that day. But when those fellas all marched out with those long billies over their shoulders around that track and took the places, the whole crowd stood up and cheered.
Who was the leader of the black group at this point locally? I mean, I know it was Martin Luther King
Martin Luther King is the one we had followed.
So it was Martin Luther King who had actually made the appearances. I see. Okay, so there was not really a local leadership carrying
out
King's
orders. He was the key to it.
Yeah, King himself was actually.
Yeah, he was the key to it. If he had said, go on with what I planned, I don't know what the plan. But if he said, go on with it, they'd have gone on with it. If he called it off, they'd have called it off.
So the fellow you saw in the car twice that day was King and apparently
some of his
adherents. It's interesting. Fascinating story. I had prefaced this by asking you earlier, you know, about achievements, and you know, we talked extensively about this this one particular achievement, accomplishment. Are there some others that you like to look back fondly?
No, other things that took place during that 8 years were small emergency floods and things like that. The guard does a good duty on every time.
Anything particularly historical, significant? You're a political scientist, as you think back over that period, that you know deserves some attention. Perhaps not today. I know you have an appointment, but when we talk again.
I don't think of anything right now.
Okay. Okay. What time's your appointment?
I got need to change clothes quite quickly.
Okay. Maybe we better stop here then.
Yep.
May we continue with this on another occasion?
If you wish.
We'd like to very much. And I want to thank you once again for your participation. It's all.
But,